continue now with our current installment of how Rav Baruch, the father of the Alter Rebbe, became a Talmud of the Baal Shem Tov. We are now up to that portion where Rav Baruch is finding out about the first Baal Shem, Rav Eliyahu Baal Shem, and how that led up to Rav Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. At the time of Rav Eliyahu Baal Shem, there lived the great Gaon and Tzaddik Rav Pinchas Zelig of Speyer. He was a very good-hearted and friendly person, very modest and patient. Despite these virtues, however, he could be very firm and unbending when he so chose. When stories began reaching him of the wonders of the Baal Shem, he decided to send three of his best scholars to visit Rav Eliyahu and see if there was any truth or foundation in the fame of this rabbi of Worms. The Baal Shem received these three messengers very kindly, and they stayed as his guests for 10 days. During this time, Rav Eliyahu learned Torah with them, taught them something of the Zohar, and revealed great secrets of the Kabbalah to these interested young men. They felt absolutely satisfied that Rav Eliyahu Baal Shem was everything that they had been led to believe, and they were absolutely thrilled with their visit, and full of admiration for the holiness and scholarship of their host. They had themselves observed how Rav Eliyahu received the many sick people who came to him for advice and help, and how after an incredibly short space of time, they left completely cured. They could hardly believe the evidence of their own eyes. The three messengers returned to their rabbi, the Gaon Rav Pinchas Zelig of Speyer, full of praise for all that they had seen and heard of the Baal Shem, and assured their rabbi that there was no question but that there here was a most remarkable and wonderful personality. At the same time, they also repeated what they had learned from him of the secrets of Kabbalah and his interpretation of the Zohar, which he had regarded as a most sacred book containing all the secrets of the Torah. Rav Pinchas Zelig became infuriated. From the day that the Zohar, which was published in Italy, had reached the rabbi in Germany, he, though a young man at the time, had started a campaign against Kabbalah and the Zohar in particular. The Zohar was first published in the year 5318, about 1558, in Manitoba and Cremona in Italy. The well-known Goyim of Italy of that period, Rabbi Zliel Tarbit, the head of the yeshiva in Ascula, and Rabbi Yosef Italink, the head of the yeshiva in Cremona, sent the published volume of the Zohar to the famous Goyim and Kabbalist Rabbi Lozer, the Rav of Frankfurt am Main. Through his efforts, other great scholars of that time in Germany became acquainted with this work, which won their wholehearted support. Rav Pinchas Zelig, however, was unaffected by the approval of these elder rabbis, and notwithstanding his youth, came forth with an all-out protest against Kabbalah and the Zohar. He managed to win many people to his side, and he had carried on the fight for 30 years. He called together an assembly of the greatest Goyim and asked them to act as the Besdin in the case he wished to put before them. He then held forth in a fiery speech of condemnation against the Baal Shem Tov, Rav Eliyahu. He told the Besdin that he had sent out three of his best scholars to find out the truth about this famous man. He said they had brought back a most favorable report about his scholarship and healing powers, but he wished to draw the attention of the Besdin to the danger of this man to whom so many people flocked in boundless admiration and faith, for he was studying Kabbalah and interpreting the Zohar according to his own ideas. After a lengthy debate, it was decided that new representatives be sent out to the Baal Shem, Rav Eliyahu Baal Shem. They chose the most notable rabbis of that time, and these were assigned the task of going to Worms and telling Rav Eliyahu that they insisted upon his giving up his original ideas and way of life. He was to cease using his magical healing powers, he was to cease studying Kabbalah and giving his own interpretations of the Zohar. The warning was to be so severe that if he refused to obey, he was to be banished from the whole of Germany, for no one in this country would continue to tolerate his peculiar way of life and ideas. Upon arrival in Worms, the messengers lost no time in informing Rabbi Leo of their mission. They told him that he was expected to give up teaching Kabbalah and using magic as part of his healing methods. If he did not agree to carry out these demands, he would be banished from the country. Rabbi Leo received the messengers with friendliness and tolerance, but endeavored to convince them that the demands brought from Rabbi Pinchas Zelig were simply unjustified. First of all, he did not admit that the latter had the right to tell him what to do in the matter of teaching Kabbalah. And regarding the second thing, he could assure them that he used no magic in his healing, and they need have no fear on that score any longer. He told them he would be happy to make the trip to the Rabbi Pinchas Zelig, as he felt that if he had the opportunity of talking with him in person, he would be able to convince him that his opposition toward him was useless and unjustified. Rabbi Leo did not merely make the suggestion, but immediately carried it out. He packed a few things together and set off for Speyer. When he called on Rabbi Pinchas Zelig, however, the latter was so prejudiced against him that he did not even want to listen to him and his theories. And so, feeling rather disappointed with the outcome of his trip, Rabbi Leo returned to Worms. But he had, he felt, shown his goodwill, and he could not help it if he had not been given a fair hearing. Naturally, seeing no reason why he should leave Germany, Rabbi Leo continued as before with his learning, the teaching of Kabbalah, as well as with his doctoring. Rabbi Pinchas Zelig was absolutely incensed at the fact that his demands had been ignored, and so set about intensifying his opposition against the Baal Shem and his followers, even more than before. He began by sending his eldest son, Reb Shammai Zundel, out in the world to warn all Jewish leaders against this dangerous Rabbi Elio, who wrapped himself in a cloak of mystery and used magic in order to make a name for himself. As is very often the case, it needed but one to begin, and there were always others ready to follow up. And so, when Rabbi Pinchas Zelig set up such a hue and cry of righteous indignation in the name of religion against Rabbi Leo Baal Shem, a number of goyim in Germany followed suit and raised their cry also against this Rabbi of Worms. Thus the fight against the Baal Shem and his followers continued for a long time, for Rabbi Pinchas Zelig did not content himself merely with sending one representative to challenge the Baal Shem, but sent many messengers out among the Jewish communities, both near and far. And when Leibner Shabtai Tzvi arose and proclaimed himself as the new Mashiach and came to such a bad end, the opponents were quick to seize upon the idea that he had been a follower of the Baal Shem of Worms. This was believed by many and strengthened the already growing opposition against Rabbi Leo, but he carried on as before, undismayed by the fight being waged against his philosophy. Later, there arose new mystics and new followers of the Hasidic line of thought established by Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. But though their ways were not entirely along the same lines as their predecessors, the Misnagdim fought against them for the same reason as their predecessors had fought against the original Hasidim. Moshe Leib, who was explaining these facts to his friend Baruch, put Rabbi Avram Zeva Bashankovich and Rabbi Simcha Zelig of Vitebsk in their present-day fight against mystics on a par with the fighters against mystics of former times. According to Moshe Leib's idea, there was little difference between Rabbi Yisroel Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, and the Baal Shem of Worms, who belonged to a different type of Kabbalist. Baruch listened to it all and felt that here he had much food for thought. He felt that the Misnagdim were making a great mistake. The new way of life established by the Baal Shem Tov and his followers had an attraction for him, which aroused all his interest. He especially wished to see wherein lay the difference between the two schools of thought, that of the Hasidim and that of the Misnagdim. He himself began to feel drawn towards Hasidim. For all that he had up to now heard about it found a ready echo in his heart. He certainly had no desire to be connected with anyone in the opposition camp who were fighting the Baal Shem Tov Mezhebish and his followers. And now a new thought arose in his mind which troubled him more and more. He had learned that Avraham Zev Bashenkovich was one of the bitterest opponents of the Baal Shem Tov and his mystics. This Avraham Zev was the teacher of Avraham, the gardener of Lashna, who was to become his father-in-law. Surely this forebode him no good. If the teacher was such a keen misnagid, then it followed that his pupil would have accepted his teacher's outlook. Carrying the matter to where it concerned him, therefore, it might also mean that the daughter of the gardener had imbibed and accepted her father's views. And here the picture did not look too rosy to Baruch. What was he to do? His marriage was planned to take place very soon. He had such wonderful memories of his parents' married life together. Everything that his father said or did was sacred to his mother, and he hoped for and envisaged his own marriage in the same happy light. And now his mind was sorely troubled. His father-in-law had promised to give Baruch a house of his own just outside the town. The house had a garden where he hoped to grow fruit and vegetables so that he could be independent and make his own living. And he had hoped to make his house a guest house for wayfarers, thereby hoping to attract some of those mystics whom he so longed to meet, to act host to, and to make their better acquaintance. But if his bride had her father's outlook, why then the whole thing was out of the question. She would neither be willing nor ready to receive these mystics into the house. Baruch said not a word about his problem to anyone, but as was his usual custom, when he wanted to think deeply, he made his way into a nearby forest, spread himself out on the grass, and lost himself deep in thought. For many hours Baruch lay thus, until suddenly he heard a familiar voice calling him by name. He looked up in surprise, and there was his friend Yitzchok Shaul, the youngest son-in-law of the smith. Yitzchok Shaul, who felt a sort of protective interest in the lonely boy, had noticed that Baruch had disappeared, and so he went in search of him. He looked in every likely place until at last he saw him lying on the grass in the forest. Baruch did not seem to hear his approach, but lay there looking rather sad and very deep in thought. Yitzchok Shaul did not feel like disturbing him immediately, so he stretched himself out on the grass and watched Baruch from a distance. Yitzchok Shaul was wondering how he could help Baruch, for he felt that mere sympathy was not sufficient in his case, Baruch being so young and away from his family. And so, after calling Baruch by name, he approached him with a friendly smile, saying, "You know, Baruch, my father told me once that the Baal Shem Tov described Avraham Avinu in the following manner. Avraham was generous three ways. He was generous with his money, with his body, and with his soul. He was always ready to give his money to whomever required it. He always put himself at the service of whoever came to his house, and he spent all his time in teaching the world about Hashem and his wonderful powers. He did not content himself with merely giving charity or even doing good deeds, but wished precisely to enlighten the ignorant people of his generation and to bring them the recognition of Hashem and of his creation." With this introductory preamble, Yitzchok Shaul wanted to show Baruch that it was his own intention too, to put himself completely at the service of his dear young friend Baruch. For so had his own father always been, wholehearted in his help and advice to whomever seemed in need of them. This he was so prepared to do for complete strangers, how much more so for his friends. Yitzchok Shaul hoped he had made himself clear to Baruch, but he saw that Baruch was still looking somewhat dazed, as if he hadn't quite pulled himself out of his thoughts into which he had sunk when his friend Yitzchok Shaul called on him. When Yitzchok Shaul saw he wasn't making much of an impression upon the thoughtful Baruch, he tried a new method of approach. "You know, Baruch," he began, "we followers of the Baal Shem Tov do not believe in having any association with sadness. We believe, rather, in joy and gladness. We avoid sadness as we would something forbidden. That is one reason why I feel somewhat strange here in the Brumzel. People here are not happy and joyful as were the people in Harki, from where I come." Baruch pricked up his ears. These words, sadness, gladness, seemed to register on his mind, and he listened to what his friend could tell him about it. "Gladness," Simcha is the aim of the chosid, while sadness seems to be the purpose of the misnagid, Yitzchok Shaul continued. Take, for instance, the matter of getting the water for matzah baking. Here in the Bromzel, the misnagdim see no reason for any particular manifestation of joy in carrying out this mitzvah of Mayim Shalonu. But you ought to see how the same mitzvahs carry out in Harki. There they have the Chassidic outlook and approach, and there it is made an occasion for real celebration. Rav Nachman Yitzchok, the Rav of Harki, was already an old man of 96 years of age, and not very strong on account of his old age. Yet would he dream of missing the ceremony of participating in the drawing of the water for matzah baking? Not he. He could no longer walk to the river as he used to. And so he arrived in the carriage. There, a plank had been fixed, and with the assistance of the shamash, the man who had almost lived through a whole century joyfully went forward to carry out this mitzvah. Pesach, the Frenchman, who was well known in Harki, waded into the river in his long sea boots, came up to the old man and lent him his shoulder as a support while he stooped down to fill a bucket with water. When the drawing of the water was at an end, the Rav made the blessing Shechionu and broke out into a joyful tune, after which he made another bracha, asking the Almighty to grant that they be worthy of the Geula through Mashiach. The singing was resumed, and all present joined in with a will. Now, just see the difference of the people of the Bromshul. Why, they don't rightly know how to rejoice on Simchas Torah. Everyone here looks so serious and earnest, even worried. I spent Sukkot here, yet I felt like a fish out of water. The mood of the people in the Bromshul is enough to make anyone feel miserable. On Shmini Atzeres, I almost got myself into trouble. I thought I would bring some life into the celebration, and so gathering a couple of young people to join me, I began to sing and dance. Some of the scholars present were deeply shocked and suggested that my behavior was disrespectful to the honor of the Torah. There was quite a lot of discussion before they decided that for ordinary working people, such a way of celebrating was permissible. Then it came to a Kofis, and I volunteered to sing some songs that had not been heard in the Bromshul before. Again, the discussion arose as to whether or not it was fitting, especially as it was accompanied by dancing and clapping of hands. The Rav and Dayan had a long talk about it before they decided that the singing could be permitted, but that the people must not clap hands in the usual way, but must somehow make a difference in this instance. Baruch was now very interested and listened eagerly as Yitzchok Shaul continued. When I first began to sing, people looked on with no special enthusiasm. But when it came to the second and third hakofa, more and more caught the tune and joined with me in the singing. Later, ever so many congregants were singing with me, for you know what singing can do to people. It has the capacity of stirring people and arousing them to the heights of enthusiasm. And in this case, too, the mispalel and the congregants were really getting warmed up. In less than no time, they were all holding hands and dancing and singing as they went around in an ever-growing circle. All of a sudden, the Rav intervened in a rush of fright, saying they must all stop immediately, as their behavior might be disrespectful to the Torah. While the celebrants stopped uncertainly, the Dayan stepped forward and quieted the Rav's misgivings by saying that he was sure it was all right, as the dancers and singers were not Torah scholars, but simple workers, and no disrespect was implied. I felt so pained, continued Yitzchok Shaul, to see the attitude of the scholars. They shook their head in disapproval thought of such unseemly behavior taking place in their Beis HaMedrash, which had never before witnessed such a scene. They were left completely unaffected and unmoved by the singing and the dancing. But on the other hand, all the work people who were present were obviously thrilled and stirred. One could see that they were positively uplifted by it all. Yitzchok Shaul went on to tell how Chaim Shimon, who had already shown a friendly attitude toward him, became now even more friendly. Or, being a musician, he even had a fiddle in his house, and very often played on it. The tunes that Yitzchok Shaul now sang made a special appeal to him. It was not only the tunes that Yitzchok Shaul sang, but his melodious voice, which drew Chaim Shimon's admiration. The dances also made a favorable impression on him. He believed that the only reason the scholars looked so disapprovingly upon the scene was to show their own superiority and to widen the gap that lay between themselves and these, as it were, ignorant workers. And so, approaching Yitzhak Shaul, he whispered in his ear, "Just you watch and see how I will pay them off." Yitzhak Shaul had no idea what he meant, but it was obvious that Chaim Shimon had something already in mind. Chaim Shimon went up to the Shamash, who was calling out the names of the men who should come forward for the Hakafas. They were up to the seventh Hakafa when Chaim Shimon said to him, "This time, don't call out any particular names, but just announce that this Hakafa is for all scholars, especially those who had no great opinion of themselves, that is, the modest ones, the Anovim." The Shamash looked up in surprise, and seeing that the request came from one who was not exactly the most important person, the Beis HaMedrash was not prepared to accept this change in the usual procedure. Chaim Shimon then went up to the Gabbai and asked him to tell the Shamash to do what he asked. Whether the Gabbai did not grasp the fact that a joke was being perpetrated against the scholars, or whether he thought that a joke was permissible on Simchas Torah, the fact is that he told the Shamash to do as he was requested. When the Shamash made his unusual and unprecedented proclamation, none of the scholars sitting in their corner in the Mizrach side, in the east side of the shul, seemed at all surprised. The first person to come forward was the Rav, who was followed by the Dayan, the judge. Then came Rabbi Shimon Saginor, the sightless, followed by Rabbi Nachman, the Porush, the ascetic, the hermit. "See," Chaim Shimon whispered to Yitzhak Shaul, wagging his finger in the direction of these scholars. "You see how much their modesty means. They cannot even see that a joke is being played on them. But wait, there's still more fun to come." Assuming an expression of complete innocence, Chaim Shimon went up to Nochum the Porush and said to him, "Now I see that you are the fourth most modest person among the scholars, for you were the fourth to step forward." "What do you mean?" Nochum the Porush protested. "If the names of the modest people in this congregation were called out in order of their modesty, I ought actually be the first person to be called. For when it comes to the question of modesty and being unassuming, there is none here who is my equal," he ended proudly. Reb Shimon Saginor looked on disapprovingly and later said to Chaim Shimon quite openly that he considered himself as being the most modest person, the greatest onuf in that congregation. "Actually, I was the first one to rise when the Shamash asked for the most modest person to step forward. But just as I wanted to step out, someone got in my way. That was not right and very unfortunate," he concluded with emphasis. Chaim Shimon felt his joke had been well worthwhile, and had certainly shown these conceited scholars in their true colors. Baruch felt he was on the borderline of two worlds. He looked into both, compared them, yet felt he belonged as yet to neither. And so he felt very isolated and alone, and this made him terribly unhappy. Particularly was he troubled when he contemplated his forthcoming alliance with a daughter of an avowed misnagid who could not be expected to sympathize with and certainly not approve of Baruch's leanings in the direction of Hasidim. Baruch felt he must be free to choose his own way of life, and he did not feel easy in his mind that his future father-in-law would try to restrict or influence him in his choice. And so what happened with Baruch? We will find out, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, in the next installment.